Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today we take you to the University of Southern Maine in Portland for a talk by Rebecca Henderson. She's a professor at the Harvard Business School, delivering the keynote address at the inaugural Timothy B. Hussey Leadership Institute. Her talk is based on a class she teaches, Reimagining Capitalism, Business, and the Big Problems. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. You can find this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs by going to mainepublic.org and click on radio. You'll also be able to find this program as a podcast. And now, here's Rebecca Henderson, Speaking in Maine.
Thank you for taking the time to come out this evening. Thank you for honoring Tim Hussey. I am so honored and delighted to be here. I never had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Hussey, but he sounds like the most amazing man. I'm going to attempt to summarize an MBA course I teach. I teach a course called Reimagining Capitalism. That's 28 1.5-hour sessions. And I have a little over 40 minutes to take you through it. So it's a lot of material to cover. Let me say that if I say anything that's interesting and you want to follow up, we just put the course up online. So you can now take Reimagining Capitalism as an online course, very cool, starting in June. And I am writing on a book, so you can always get the book or the movie too. So Reimagining Capitalism, that's like a big title, right? So what am I talking about? I really want to talk about three ideas this evening. The first is, what is the business of business? For the last 50 years, we've pretty much accepted that the business of business is shareholder value maximization. That's like what businesses do. And in fact, we've persuaded ourselves that to do anything else is not only possibly illegal, but also immoral, and definitely a bad idea when you're talking to your shareholders. So one of the questions I want to revisit is, why do we think the business of business is shareholder value maximization? And is it time to rethink our understanding of what business should do? And for those of you who are going to leap to your feet and rush out, I'm going to suggest that, yes, it's time to go back to the future, that servant leadership that sometimes we think of as an old-fashioned way of running a company is, in fact, the future, is perhaps our best hope for the future. And I'm going to argue that to adopt a purpose beyond shareholder value maximization is not only legal and moral, but quite possibly profitable. And so that's the first case I'm going to try and make. I'm then going to try and persuade you that, yes, purpose-driven firms can thrive in today's world. Because as you heard, I'm on the IDEX board, and may I say what a pleasure and delight that has been. I've been on the board for 15 years, and when I joined, IDEX was a teeny tiny company, and that's quite big, which is very cool. But it's given me a chance to come to Maine many times, and I really enjoy it. But, you know, I sit on two big public boards, so I know if you don't make your numbers, you're not going to be around. And rule one in my MBA course is don't crash the company. This is not walking around with your bleeding heart, showing on your jacket, saving the world. This is about running a thriving and profitable enterprise that can really make a difference, and about holding those two in tension in a way that makes you a very successful business person. So the second thing I'm going to try and persuade you of is that, yes, you can think about these bigger questions and still run a really excellent business. And I'll show you some research in that direction. The third question I want to tackle is in many ways the hardest. So suppose we persuaded a whole bunch of firms that they could do more than just maximize shareholder value. And suppose they turned out to be big and successful and innovative. Well, that would be great. But would it really make a difference? I mean, a few firms might change a few light bulbs, and maybe they would pay their employees better. But we have massive global problems. And surely business is not the right instrument for addressing these huge problems. Surely we need social change, better politics, really a revolution in society. The idea that business can change the world seems a little strange. Now, you're all sitting looking at me very politely, so, but I know what some of you are thinking because people say it to my face. I took my proposal for my book around editors in New York City, and one of them looked at me and he said, "Rebecca, business saves the world? Are you insane? Don't you read the papers?" And so many people think business is part of the problem, and that, in fact, we should move away from capitalism. One recent study amongst millennials suggested that over half of them didn't believe in capitalism anymore, and that we have these massive global firms that are busy making a ton of money for themselves and leaving everyone else off to the side. One of my senior colleagues, whose name you would know if I told you, he's in the papers, he looked at me and he said, "Well, Rebecca, this is very interesting, but you are either stupid or corrupt." I said, "Well, thank you very much." So I just want to let you know before we start that I know this is a heavy lift. So the last question I want to cover is, could business make a difference? Can we see a path from a few purpose-driven businesses doing the right thing to really shifting the world and really making a difference against the problems we face? So you're beginning to get a sense of why it's 28 one-and-a-half-hour sessions, yeah? Okay, so here we go. So let's begin at the beginning. What is the business of business? Now, almost everyone who shows up in our classrooms at Harvard has an easy answer. They say the social responsibility of business is to increase its profits, and the business of business is to maximize shareholder value. I think it's really important to understand that at one time, this was a very good answer. So why did we think for so long that it was all about maximizing shareholder value? Well, let me try and summarize 50 years of intense economic thought in 3 minutes, but here we go. Think about what business does. It creates jobs, and it creates goods and services. And a well-run business does that very efficiently. So it uses as few inputs as possible and gives us iPhones and cars and hot water and holidays in Jamaica. And so firms are like, really a good thing. You know, and often amongst my lefty friends, they're like, "Oh, business." I'm like, "Do you like your warm house and your car and, you know, you like that stuff? That's from business." So we think of business as a really efficient tool for generating what I'm going to call prosperity or wealth. And I don't just mean material wealth. We've got a lot of data that one of the things that makes people happiest is a good job. So that there are many ways in which business, in creating prosperity, creates a lot of well-being. And businesses working in the free market are just super good at generating prosperity. World GDP, world population has tripled in my father's lifetime, and he's still alive. And GDP per head has quintupled over the same period. And that's the power and dynamism of the free market. It's incredible. I'm a professor at the Harvard Business School. I love capitalism. So the first reason we said your social responsibility is to increase profits is because increasing profits means your firm's efficient, means you're generating, the market's efficient, means you're generating a lot of wealth. Fabulous. Second reason to say this is because you like individual freedom. And we think, you know, us economists, that the free market is one of the best instruments ever invented to support individual freedom. That if everybody's working for the local boss because he's the only guy in town and he's baron to something, and you know, we have the feudal system or we have the boss system or everyone works for the state, that you don't have choice. And that what gives people political freedom is the opportunity to work in many different ways and to control their own economic lives. So we have Milton Friedman and his colleagues saying, you know, free market's really a good thing, prosperity and freedom, check. And then Mike Jensen comes along and says, and by the way, it's your investors' money. So if you take your investors' money and you do anything else with it other than give them good returns, You're throwing their money out the window, and it's not your money. So technically, that's called agency costs. But those are three pretty compelling reasons. Let's maximize shareholder value. Let's go. Okay, so I'm with the program. But something seems slightly off in the world. I don't know about you, but have you noticed? Like, something's not quite right. So what's going on out there? Well, we've got massive problems. I mean, this is just a quick summary. Sometimes I open talks by saying, okay, what gets you up at 4 in the morning and cover 15 boards? But roughly, we have two big problems and a third one lurking in the background. Our first big problem is we are running through the planet like there is no tomorrow. We're cutting down the trees, we're destabilizing the atmosphere, we're acidifying the ocean, we're filling it with plastic. It's not good, right? So our enormous and very successful civilization has taken the Earth as basically for free. Let's take what we want, let's dump what we want, cool, but now there are 7 billion of us and we're doing it at an enormous scale and we got problems. Second big problem, the fruits of what we've produced are getting a little unequally distributed. Now, there are two issues here. You know, I have no problem with Bill Gates being a seriously rich guy. I mean, he created an enormous amount of wealth for his shareholders and fantastic value for lots of people in the world. I don't mind Steve Jobs being a rich guy or Mark Zuckerberg. He's producing a product that people really want. No problem with that. My problem is whether it's getting harder and harder to do that if you're born in the wrong family, wrong place, wrong color. If we no longer have real freedom of opportunity, if there are huge numbers of people who don't get to play, then the free market no longer brings freedom. It only brings freedom to people who can play. And if our health system or our educational system or our racial disparities lead it to be the case that we have lots of people who don't even make the starting line, that's a serious problem. And the other reason inequality really worries me is money is often power. We now live in a world in which the 50 richest people in the world control more wealth than the entire bottom 50% of humanity. The four Walmart children between them are wealthier than the 50% less wealthy in the US. And money brings power. You've probably seen the statistics which show that if you run a correlation between what the public claims it wants and what Congress passes, there's almost no correlation. If you look at what the top 1% would like by way of policy and the policies we get, we're getting a lot of those policies. Now, this is not to say that, oh, the rich are corrupt or they're out for bad stuff. Nothing like that. I've been fortunate enough to meet some of these people, and they're lovely people. And they have very strong opinions, just like you and me, right? And if I was worth $20 billion, I would be in D.C., you know, saying, hey, what about this? It's just dangerous. It's dangerous to have power concentrated like this. And you can see, at the same time, we have our institutions under enormous stress. And I won't go into like what's going on, but the inequality is feeding into a rejection of the elites, which is feeding into some horrible politics. So, world is falling apart. This is the fishing grounds in the North Atlantic. You probably know this. This is the collapse of the cod fishery. It's one of my classic, like, we have serious environmental problems. This was once the most productive fishing ground in the world, and it's collapsed and never recovered. So this is my image of environmental problems, just taking it too fast, too hard. And this is my image for inequality. This is a house belonging to a man called Mukesh Ambani, who is the richest man in India. He owns $21.6 billion personally. And the house includes a 6-level parking garage, 9 elevators, a grand ballroom with a silver staircase, 4-story open garden, an entertainment level with a 40-seat movie theater, and my favorite, a health level with a lap pool, yoga studio, dance studio, and an ice room featuring snow flurries in Mumbai. like something is not quite right, right? Something is off. And this is the cartoon that really captures it for me. Yes, the planet got destroyed, but for a beautiful moment in time, we created a lot of value for shareholders. So, like, what is going on? What is the relationship between this very successful private sector and the problems we face, and how should we think about this? So now I'm going to throw some intense theory at you, okay? So if it's intense, just kind of sing for a moment, and we'll get out the other side. So I'm going to suggest that the business of business should no longer be the maximization of shareholder value. The business of business should be the maximization of prosperity and freedom. And you're going to say, wait, isn't that the same as the old answer? Well, yes, it is the same as the old answer, but it's subtly different. Because maximizing shareholder value was a route to prosperity and freedom. And if you live in a world where, and here's the technical stuff, externalities are not properly priced. How many people have any idea what I mean when I say that? A few of you. Okay. So for the rest of you, it's really a simple idea. If I get to throw carbon dioxide out of the window, even when I know it's destabilizing the planet and will create untold havoc for thousands of generations, and I'm not prevented, the market is not free and fair. If I can dump my waste in the river for free, it's not a free market because things are not properly priced. About 156 million people die every year because we burn fossil fuels, principally coal because of the particulate emissions from coal. And yet in many countries, coal is actively subsidized. If you do the calculation when you look at the cost of the deaths from the pollution, and you look and you put some estimate on the carbon damage that you're causing, every single coal company in the world is running at a very considerable loss. You don't see it because we don't have accurate pricing. So that's the first problem. The second problem is exactly the issue of access that I mentioned. Is maximizing shareholder value creates freedom and prosperity as long as everyone gets to play. And if not everyone gets to play, if we don't have a health system or an educational system that equips people to play, it's not free and fair. And even worse, if I get together with my friends and I fix the rules in my favor, the market is not free and fair.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Harvard Business Professor Rebecca Henderson is asking us to reimagine capitalism and what it means for a business to maximize shareholder value.
So let me give you the issue that really catches it for me. I say, maximize shareholder value. What's your name, sir? Philip? So I go to Philip and I say, hey, maximize shareholder value. And he says, well, I'm just making this up. I can maximize shareholder value by moving operations to Papua New Guinea, bribing the locals, dumping all our stuff in the river, and, you know, it's going to be great. We're going to run the most polluting mine you ever saw, and we are going to destroy the local institutions, but my God, we're going to get rich. And I say, well, Philip, that's, you know, great initiative. But and I'm sure he wouldn't actually do that. He's just, you know, responding to me because I'm so aggressive. But notice that you can maximize shareholder value and not increase either prosperity or freedom. And that's the problem. What we need is a free market that is balanced and contained. And the thing is, when Milton Friedman came up with his whole thing about maximize shareholding value, the free markets in the West were pretty balanced and contained. It was after World War II. Strong governments, well-respected, a strong sense of the community, of the social us, and business was, you know, pretty much playing by the rules, pretty good education, pretty good health, not so much, but not so bad. But it was pretty much in balance. What we have now is a world out of balance. Very strong business, less and less balance. So far, so good. I mean, I know at a dinner party, if we were just sitting down, you know, you'd be like plying me with like, wait. So I understand, I'm going really fast. But just for a moment, bear with me. So when externalities are properly priced, there's adequate investment in public goods such as education and health, and the power of the rich is balanced by free media and a strong democracy. I don't want to get rid of the rich. I want the incentive to work hard, but let's have it balanced. Then maximizing shareholder value maximizes both freedom and prosperity. But if firms can dump waste into the river, lie to their consumers, and get together to fix prices, you no longer have a free and fair market. So let's go from focusing only on shareholder value maximization to building a thriving business that rewards its investors, no crashing the company, but also takes responsibility for the health of the natural and social systems on which we rely. You don't get a free pass just for you, because you're a business, from worrying about the health of the world you live in. It's on your plate. If you want to maximize freedom and prosperity, you have to think about the whole thing. So that's step one. And maybe you'll look like Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life, who's a good exemplar. You know, and remember, he ran his business for the good of the whole community, and that's what he cared about. Yes, he needed to make money, but that wasn't the goal of the firm. Okay, so far, so good. We think it's okay to be purpose-driven. It turns out to be legal as well. I could ask the Yale Law School person to talk about that, but it turns out to be completely legal. As long as you don't announce that what you're doing will definitely lose money for your investors, you can do pretty much anything. that was very loose. But your fiduciary duties are care, candor, and loyalty. They are not maximize shareholder value right now. So it's completely legal to run a firm like this. The more pressing question is, will you survive? So let me give you a little bit of data to suggest that you will, and then I'll turn to the question of whether it would make any difference. So this is a surprising fact. This is a fact that within four-digit SIC industries, that sort of well-defined industries in the US manufacturing sector, the average difference in logged total factor productivity, you don't need to know what that means. What it is how much stuff you get out from how much stuff you put in. So if you're more productive, you get more stuff out for the same capital, labor, energy, and so on. The average difference in logged total factor productivity between an industry's 90th and 10th percentile is a number, which means the plants at the 90th percentile, on average, make almost twice as much output with the same measured inputs as the 10th percentile plant. The most productive plants in nearly every industry are more than twice as productive as the least with the same input. Now, you're probably sitting there thinking, are you sure? So Glenn mentioned I'm a member of the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is a sort of get together a bunch of empirical economists and look at data. And I spent the first 20 years of my career in conference rooms looking at this result. Nobody believed it. We got data from plants, very detailed data. We controlled for everything we could lay our hands on. And there was always this, we used to call it a firm effect, that somehow some firms were just much more productive than others. And for 10 years, nobody believed it. And we just jumped up and down on this result. Now everybody believes it. This is now a standard result in the economics profession. Now we're having a very lively conversation about what's causing it. Like, what is going on? So one possible explanation is the firms at the bottom of the distribution, the ones that are very unproductive, are just not listening. There's a much better way to run firms, and they're just not listening. Because we know that the difference in productivity is correlated with what's called high performance work, high-performance work systems. How many people know what a high-performance work system is? Oh, dear. Thank you, sir. We can get together for a beer afterwards. Okay, nothing fancy in a high-performance work system. Do you remember Toyota? Yeah? Toyota invented the high-performance work system at scale. What does it mean? It means we run by teams, we fix problems, we don't lie to each other, we communicate deeply, and we have shared values. In fact, those of you who are really gluttons for punishment, I have a paper on why it took General Motors about 30 years to work out that Toyota was doing something different. So there's something about an environment where people trust each other, communicate, are willing to work, try more things, have initiative, that just has a huge effect on productivity. So why isn't it spreading? It may just be that some people just haven't got the memo. And there are people who haven't got the memo. If you look at the distribution of productivity, it's much wider in India and China. There's some very badly managed firms because they haven't had the kind of education that we get access to here. But even in the US and France and Sweden, you see this distribution. So my explanation is it's all about purpose. It's all about working for a firm where you know what the firm's about. I mean, imagine coming into work. I'm sure none of you would do it and go, hey, another great day to maximize shareholder value. You know, no decent CEO does that, like no one. It's about having a real purpose, being excited for why you're there, why you're working together. And this is the focus of my scholarly research. So if you're at all curious, click on my website and you'll see some of my papers. But for the moment, let me just show you a little piece of evidence that this is out there. So the first is a summary of what the research tells us about the relationship between purpose and performance. So we know that purpose generates shared beliefs about the future, which enables you, I say lower wages, that's so badly put, it means people will do more work for the same amount of wages. That if you know why you're doing and you're excited about where you're going and you're part of the mission, you're going to work harder, you're aligned on the strategy. Purpose gives you authenticity. That is, you think the senior management might actually be decent people who will follow through on their commitments. That gives you intrinsic motivation, like you're really excited about the work for its own sake and a dense set of social relationships. And it also gives you identity and pro-sociality. And I won't talk much about that, but we have a lot of research. Every one of those arrows is a bunch of scholarly papers that purpose drives identity, drives dense social relationships, drives performance. So we've got a lot of research suggests that these individual links are there. And this is this is a graph of that, which is in an organization, you have people who are actively hostile, barely compliant, just doing the job, willing to go the extra mile, and on fire with excitement and creativity. And in most organizations, not yours, I'm sure, the distribution of employees is sort of, you've got a bunch of actively hostile and a bunch of on fire, but most people are just doing the job. I'm sure you know this. Gallup thinks that only about a third of the US workforce is actively engaged at work. And if you can get purpose, you can move the distribution. That's what we're talking about, is moving the distribution. Let me show you a little quantitative evidence that this makes a difference. This is from a paper by my colleague, George Serafim, and a student whose thesis I supervised. What they looked at is the relationship between a return on assets and whether people felt purpose-driven. And they had a really good measure of purpose derived from 4.5 million employee surveys. Like, did people really feel purpose-driven? And if you just run purpose on financial performance, you get nothing. Nothing. You can be a purpose-driven firm. You don't look worse, but you don't look better. And then they divided the sample into two. One half of the sample, let's say this side, it was all about camaraderie and family feeling. So you were purpose-driven, and you really felt like you had strong family feeling. And over here, this was purpose-driven, but very clear goals. You knew exactly where you were going to go. One of these groups outperforms. Which one? Point. So we've got a lot of division. Some people think clearly family. Some people think clearly goals. It's goals. Because the thing about being a purpose-driven leader is in many ways it's harder than being a regular leader. You can't crash the company. You've got to be very focused on what you're doing. You've got to be a superb businessman. You've got to find the business model that doesn't involve moving to Papua New Guinea and destroying your place. You've got to do the right thing. So you've got to be a very good business person. And if you can do that, you can outperform. So it's not that camaraderie is bad. It doesn't guarantee outperformance. Okay, so got to the last question. So the story so far, one, it's legal and moral and appropriate to think about more than just maximizing shareholder value. Two, you can survive as a firm while doing so. So far, so good. Now, about saving the world. Like, is it really going to make a difference? I mean, it'd be great to have a few more firms that do the right thing and are thinking big, but does it really make a difference? So here's where I'm really going to walk out on a limb, and I'm going to argue that not only do I think purpose-driven firms could make a difference, I think they might be the central catalyst that shift the system. So that's a big claim. So how? What do I think could happen? And let me just say, I told you this at first, that like many people think I'm nuts. So that's okay. Go right ahead anyway. So here's the theory. The big problem is all societies need to hold a balance between focusing on me and focusing on the whole society. And everyone needs to hold a balance between focusing on right now and later. And at the moment, our society is doubled down on me right now. Right? We've got a me now society. Now, historically, there have been a number of institutions whose job it was to focus on us and later. So how did we do us and later historically? Whose job was that? The church? So the big faith traditions are all over. No, it's very unskillful to be focused just on yourself and just now. Think about us later. So the big faith traditions. Who else was thinking about us and later? Indigenous peoples, a strong cultural tradition about us and later. There are strong cultural traditions in the West, too, about focusing on us and later, but they've got very submerged, good. So it could be in the culture, in the mythology. Who else was thinking about us and later? Government. Right. And what do most people think about government right now? Take it out and drown it in the bathtub. Right? So the institutions that historically have been holding us and later are pretty much under stress everywhere. And wait, it gets worse. Fixing this problem is much easier in smaller groups. So if you're in a relatively small society where everyone knows everyone else, it's much easier to say, no, let's do it for all of us. Right? Let's not drink all the water in the aquifer this year. Let's leave it because all of us will like it next year. Much easier in small groups. But we're the opposite of small groups now, right? We've gone to global level. We weren't that great at us and later in fairly small scale, and now we've got it at the global scale. So this is kind of sobering. If you're an economist, you instantly try and contain your despair and anxiety by calling it a prisoner's dilemma. How many people have heard of the prisoner's dilemma? Okay, so a few of you. Everyone who's heard of it, you can explain it to the person next to you after the talk. But let me give you the intuition. The intuition says, we can get together and do the right thing. Let's call that cooperation. Or we can keep doing what we're doing now and just focusing on me and now. So let's suppose we're thinking about an aquifer. Let's suppose we're, you know, Cape Town. We're in a water-stressed environment. And the right thing to do is everyone reduces their water use and invests in long-term water infrastructure, and together we'll build a healthy society, right? Not so hard. You're all up for that? Like, we're going to invest in the water infrastructure and build it strong, and it's going to be great. Now, here's the issue. So what's your name?
Savannah.
So Savannah is running a highly profitable, cool, but kind of at the edge company, okay? So you're just marginally profitable. I say, Savannah, I've got this great plan. We are going to fix the water problems in this city. I'm going to ask you to invest in water-saving equipment, cut your own water use right now. It'll be a little bit expensive, but you'll save money in the long term. And I want you to join me in voting for higher taxes to pay for water infrastructure. And Savannah says, because she's a very polite person, of course, Rebecca, that sounds like a great idea. Of course, I'll cooperate with you. And if we all do that, we fix the problem. Yeah? So in that case, cooperate, much better than defect. If none of us invest, we're going to run out of water. It's going to be bad. So she's totally on the wavelength, cooperate, better than defect. Now, there's something really important here, which is, this is not just some example I've made up. The business community would be much better off if we address some of these big problems, right? It's not a good business case for destabilizing the climate, flooding the coastal cities, destroying the productivity of agriculture, and seeing mass migration. That's not good for business. It's not good for business to have people so angry and aggressive that they elect officials who behave incredibly erratically. Sometimes they behave in your favor, sometimes not, but very erratic. So Savannah understands, like intellectually, because she's very smart, that it would be great if everybody cooperated. But we have a problem. What is the problem? What is Savannah going to be tempted to do as soon as I'm out of her office? She's going to say, well, you know, I'm kind of at the edge financially. Other people should cut back on using water, and other people should invest in the infrastructure, and that'll be good. But me right now, I'm going to be much better off if I don't sign up. And the prisoner's dilemma is some fancy math around that happens a lot. We get tempted to defect. We're always tempted to defect. Now, in small groups, what stops that defection? Why is it that in small groups, you pretty much take care of the water supply and clean up the waste? What happens in a small group? Peer pressure, right? I know Savannah. In fact, my brother is married to her sister. And I say, Savannah, you don't do this, you know, life is going to be very unhappy. And I say that very politely, but, you know, it's a lot of peer pressure. The other alternative is we have a government that we both respect that implements the regulations and makes sure we both line up. Or we have a faith tradition that we share that says, no, this is the honorable thing to do, and we all join in. The trouble is we're living in a world in which cooperate is difficult to maintain. So the biggest problem we face is persuading all the business to do this together. That's the issue. If you can get everyone to sign on, no one's at a competitive disadvantage, everyone's better off, we're done. All we need to do is solve the prisoner's dilemma at global scale. But that's all we need to do, okay? So the long-term answer, and those of you in the room studying political science or have a political background, the long-term answer is a strong society, a strong culture, rule of law, governments. That's how we're going to solve this in the long term. Business cooperating is not a long-term solution to this problem. It's not stable. What we need is running our society better. No problem. So all we need is for business to really understand it should get involved in building inclusive institutions. And I'm sorry, this is like a lot to throw on you, but just think intuitively, we need like a decent way to get together and decide what we want to do. But it's not going to happen now, right? I was talking to the CEO of a big chemical company, and he told me, he said, Rebecca, you know, life is really interesting at the moment. I was in a meeting with some of my leading shareholders, and I, you know, told them about all our great growth plans and how we were going to invest in R&D and what our quarterly earnings were going to be. And they asked me all the standard questions, and I gave them all the standard answers, and that was great. And then there was a pause. And I said to them, do you think global warming is real? And the investor said, yeah, I think it's real. And the CEO said, and do you have children? And they said, yeah, we have children. And he said, are you worried? And they said, yeah, we're really worried. And he said, and do you think government is going to fix it? And they said, no. So what are we going to do instead? That's the question.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Rebecca Henderson is asking us to reimagine capitalism. She's about to show us examples of companies that have already taken the first few steps.
So, happy news. The top 1,000 firms control about 73% of the world's GDP. Now, from some perspectives, that's truly scary, right? If you don't find that statistic scary, you should. That's a lot of concentration of power, so that's not so good. But here's the good news. Could you imagine a world in which 200 or 300 of those CEOs got together and said, you know, destabilizing the planet is really a bad idea. Not respecting human rights, really a bad idea. Let's get together. Let's try and make it work. And essentially what I'm going to do is tell you a story of how that might really happen. So, we need to think about this as an innovation problem. We've lived in a world where natural and social capital are essentially free. We can ensure, you know, somebody else's business to worry about looking after the environment or looking after education and health or thinking about opportunity. And we're going to move to a world in which natural and social capital are key to making money. And by the way, there's going to be a strong collective case for that. All we need to do is get everyone to move. So let me give you a preview of what I'm going to suggest. We're going to have 5 steps. Step 1, a few people go first. And in going first, they demonstrate the business model. So one example would be Walmart. You're familiar with Walmart? So a few years ago, Walmart decided that for a variety of reasons, mostly to do with PR, they were going to invest heavily in reducing energy use in their operations. They were going to, for example, upgrade their transportation fleet. And they thought they'd save around $300 million a year if they really focused and really changed their transportation fleet. Anyone guess what they ended up saving? They thought they'd get $300 million. And this is Walmart, pretty tightly run company. They thought they'd get $300 million a year. What do you think they got? They got triple. They got $1 billion a year. $1 billion a year out of improving the efficiency of the trucking fleet. Everywhere they turned, they started finding money. The best data we have suggests that energy conservation gives you, on average, a 16% rate of return. I don't know about you, but that's a very nice rate of return. So the first step is few people go first. So let's see, I think I have these 5 steps written out. So I'm going to call that exploiting shared value. You do the right thing and you make money. Shared value. Step 1. That step turns out to be really important. Why? Because everyone else goes, oh, that looks okay. I'll go do that too. And you might invent new ways of behaving. Lipton Tea, for example, announced that they were going to move to completely sourcing completely sustainable tea. And it turns out that when they made that announcement, they hadn't done the financial analysis. They just thought it was the right thing to do and they would find a way to make it work. And it gave them 3 points of market share in a highly commoditized market. It gave them security of supply. And it gave them talent acquisition like you wouldn't believe. This is one of my favorite factoids. The 5 most attractive employers in the world are, this is from LinkedIn, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, Unilever. Unilever makes soap. And face cream. and it's one of the five most attractive firms in the world. That's where the kids want to work. Because they went first, and they showed that it could be done. They tipped the whole industry. The whole tea industry is now going sustainable. So once you've done that, everybody gets excited. Then you start building cooperation. You say, okay. And one of the things that's interesting is we talked about peer pressure. So what sustains cooperative equilibria? One, it has to be better for the group. And for the consumer goods companies, all of them had massive potential brand damage if they were caught using the bad stuff. So yes, okay, if you do it, I'll do it. So it's a big payoff. That's great. Second thing, they put in auditing and monitoring. So if anyone cheated, everybody knew. And they would get rid of people who cheated. And the third thing is peer pressure. It's only 60 CEOs we're talking about. They see each other every day. They're building a relationship which is about not only doing this in palm oil, but doing it in soy and doing it in beef and doing it in the other big agricultural commodities. So that's cooperation. Third step. So far, so good? Yeah. Third step. So you build cooperation. You're excited. In, for example, the big mining and minerals companies get together, and they decide that they're going to pull back from corruption. That if they all agree not to pay bribes, if no one's paying bribes, no one gets an advantage from it, that's a much better way to compete. So we're all going to promise not to pay bribes. Sounds good, right? Tiny problem, it's really tempting to pay those bribes. Really, really, really tempting. So you need someone else to say, don't you do that. So you go to the banks and you say, you implement the Equator Principles. You say you will not lend money to firms who behave badly. You get the suppliers of capital to start enforcing cooperation. Did any of you follow Larry Fink's letter to shareholders this spring? So Larry Fink runs BlackRock, which is one of the largest collection of money on the planet. It manages more than $6 trillion in assets. And Larry Fink sent a letter to all the firms in his portfolio this year that said, firms have a social responsibility to care about the social and environment, social context and environmental damage they are causing. And you would have thought he'd said, I'm a socialist! And everyone's like, what the heck are you doing? So here's the deal. Suppose you control $6 trillion worth of assets. You cannot diversify away from the risks that the big problems present. If you're just a little investor, you can invest in like the good energy companies. Or you can say, well, I'm going to invest in those agricultural people who are not going to be hit by global warming, or those people who won't have labor trouble. But if you've got a portfolio that you're going to hold for 30 or 40 years, and you have to hold every stock on the planet, global warming is a risk to your portfolio. Labor unrest is a risk to your portfolio. Institutional degradation is a risk to your portfolio. So you have now Larry Fink getting together with the head of the CalPERS pension fund in California, getting together with the people at State Street who run like $4 trillion in assets, getting together with the Japanese pension fund, which runs $1.5 trillion in assets, and they're saying, you need to think about these environmental and social stuff. And we will hold you responsible for doing that. At Exxon's last board meeting, Exxon's management recommended that these wild and crazy activists who'd asked Exxon to publish a report saying, how would we think about climate change? You just make it go away. Don't vote for that. The big investors voted yes, and Exxon had to respond. This is a major shift. And you know the even better news? I love this piece of news. Once you get firms reporting what they're doing on environmental, social, and governance indicators, you can then start running that against financial numbers. And the evidence is increasingly compelling that those firms who are performing better on ESG metrics are performing better financially. So now you've got a chunk of the mainstream investment community saying, you remember all that data about purpose leads you to perform better? It appears to be actually true. And so you've got the mainstream investors saying, do you have an environmental strategy? Do you have a social strategy? It has to be done well. It has to be measured well. This is not easy. But we're seeing the financial community really beginning to exert pressure in this direction. And last but not least, business is beginning to just tiptoe into social and political change. And here I'm talking about two kinds of things. I'm talking about the CEOs after Charlottesville being willing to stand up and say, this is not okay. If you think about it, no serious CEO would ever dream of saying, you know, I don't like child labor, but it's very profitable, and so, you know, yeah, we use it. Like, none of them would say that. And we need to build a world in which it's not okay to say, yeah, I voted against the tax bill for the University of Southern Maine. I mean, yeah, it's a great institution. They really need the money. But, you know, I'm maximizing shareholder value. I don't want my taxes to go up. That shouldn't be okay. It shouldn't be okay to throw CO2 out the window and actively deny that climate change is real. That's not okay. And you're seeing more and more CEOs stepping forward. What you're seeing, which I think is really interesting, I go to a lot of conferences, you know, sustainable this, sustainable that, and you meet some of the leaders of these really advanced companies. And what's fascinating is you see them going through this. So take Nike, for example. You may remember Nike had a horrible image problem, and they were caught really abusing people in their supply chain. So they said, okay, we're going to clean it up. And they tried to clean it up on their own, and they discovered you can't do that. The textile and shoe supply chain, so many people involved, you have to work with tons of people. Everybody has to decide they're going to clean up their supply chain. So they started the Sustainable Apparel Coalition. Everybody said, okay, we're going to clean up our supply chain. We're going to audit. We're going to run. You know, we're going to run clean. We're all going to protect our brands. We're going to do the great thing. Fabulous. No, there's too many people at the edges still slipping away. Too hard to control a global supply chain with hundreds of thousands of suppliers. And so now what they're saying at the conference is, you know, we have to go to the government of Vietnam and say, would you please enforce the labor laws? One of the problems we have in this defect world is that we've had a race to the bottom, where firms move to wherever the law is least enforced, costs are lower, you can get away with behaving badly. And so the firms are now saying, oh, maybe that was a mistake. Maybe we need government to enforce sensibly and well, in a democratic context, rules that hold us all to account. This is not an old idea, but thinking about doing it at scale is what's new. So you're beginning to see these five steps of change. Let me take that just a little bit slower. So here's creating shared value. You get to make money and solve the big problems at the same time. Excellent. So Elon Musk is a fascinating man. Right? He says, yes, no more kind of futzing around with electric vehicles at the edge. Let's go for it. And so this is the classic model for creating shared value. Let's get consumers to pay more because it's high status or they feel good about it. Now, I start with this one because most people assume this is the model for creating shared value. It's probably the least important. I wish this weren't the case, but most people are unwilling to pay more for sustainable products. What they are willing to do is shift their purchase behavior. So you get firms like Clorox, who moved into green cleaning products. They don't charge more, but they shift people into their product. Next model, invest in sustainability because otherwise the world's going to come down on your head. This is Coca-Cola. They were accused of plundering water from local communities. Can't do that, you're running brand risk. Another model, 15% rate of return on reducing energy use. This is the Empire State Building, completely green, heavy investment in energy conservation, very high rates of return. This is Walmart. This is their $1 billion a year in the trucks. And this is Zipcar, entirely new businesses. So there are a bunch of new businesses that you can really create money in moving to shared value. This is the Flyknit. This is Nike's product. How many of you knew that the Flyknit is a highly sustainable product? Anyone know? Yeah, most people don't know. It was originally started as a sustainability project. It's now their leading edge tech platform. It's very cool. So here's the way I'd like you to think about it. So often, when you're inside an organization and you say, we should do sustainability, they look at you and go, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. I mean, nice, but it's not going to happen. So I want to show you an exercise I do with energy companies. I started doing this 10 years ago. And I said to them, so tell me, what does the future look like? Is there going to be carbon regulation? They say, oh, no, 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 but there might be. And then 10 years ago, I'd say to them, and do you think renewable energy will ever be competitive? And they'd say, oh, no, no, but it might be. So you say, well, give me the odds on those. What's the odds on those happening? No carbon regulation, 80%. It's never going to happen. You know, we're never going to get carbon regulation. It's only 20%. By the way, those people under 30 in the room, what are the odds we'll have real carbon regulation within 10 years? Is it high? Yeah? Of course it's going to happen, right? We're going to get carbon regulation. How about renewable energy expensive? Well, maybe 40% odds that we'll get renewable energy competitive. And so, look, I told you, business as usual, 48% chance of happening. I told you it was the most likely future. And that green, you know, this green paradise down at the bottom, 8%. I told you I was giving you energy company odds. So these are their odds. I'm with you. I would give much stronger odds for a different future, but these are their odds. And this is the way, if you ever do this analysis, do it with the people in the room's odds, not your own. What's important about this diagram is it says that business as usual, the future that they're counting on, is less than a 50% chance of happening. This changes conversations. You're no longer saying green paradise will definitely happen, which gets you labeled as a green fanatic and marginalized. You're saying, let's play the odds. And this is the business case. The world is changing. Consumer sentiment is changing. Technologies are changing. The supply chains are shifting. You've got to hedge against that. So this is my shared value. And when you get firms starting to invest in this direction, you get a whole bunch of positive effects. They demonstrate new technology. They legitimate new approaches. It's the amazing people who went out and put on those first solar panels and pushed and pushed and pushed who brought the cost down faster than anyone thought possible. So much so that 10 years from now, I think the odds are very good we'll have clean energy cheaper than coal. That's because a few firms took the risk and found the business case and pushed. You can really make a difference. You can change whole industries. So once you've done shared value, then you can start to build cooperation. And once you've got all these groups working together, they say, well, it would be really helpful to have support. So let's rewire the capital markets. Let's support social change. And let's maybe, just maybe, reinvest in good government. And if we could do that, we could change the world.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Rebecca Henderson, a Harvard business professor whose talk is called Reimagining Capitalism. She recently delivered the keynote address for the Timothy B. Hussey Leadership Institute at the University of Southern Maine. If you missed part of the program or you want to hear it again, you can always find it online at mainepublic.org. Just click radio to find this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock and Explosions in the Sky. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.